Welcome to the Family Story Podcast, where we talk about family relationships, important family events, and most of all, family stories that can be passed on for generations to come. I'm your host, Rick Jensen, and I'm glad you've joined us today. So sit back, listen, learn, and love as we talk about your family in this episode of the Family Story Podcast. I'm so glad you were able to join us today on the Family Story Podcast. I am excited about this project that I've been working on. I found some CDs in my dad's things after he passed away, which actually has the life story of my grandfather, Ernie Jensen, in his own words. So this interview that I'm doing today is done posthumously because he passed away in 1982. And I am happy to welcome him to the studio today through modern technology. So let's just go ahead and get started. Grandpa Jensen, you were born in 1901, and your life is in a time period where it was a different world than what we are used to. Tell us what it was like growing up in the early 1900s in Weber County.
I remember we used to go down there by the 12th Street Fire Station. It was a spring, and we used to stop there and get a drink with an old tin cup on a chain. Then my dad would come after me at night in his little horse and buggy and take us home.
That introduction to your life right there about getting a drink of water from a tin cup on a chain and then getting a ride with your dad in a horse and buggy. Such a different world. Tell me about your relationship with your father.
I used to follow my dad all over. We were together all the time, it seemed like. And when I was about 4.5, 5 years old, he says to me, "Dad, son, I've got a job for you." He used to have a lot of fish ponds there, and he'd raise these fish. And I can remember when he used to sell them to the White Elephant, Vienna Senate, and Potter Cafe. He used to get 25 cents a piece for them. And I can remember when he used to strip those fish, and I'd help him and for the eggs. And we'd strip those eggs from them and get about two dozen fish eggs in a pan. Then we'd strip the male in with them and mix them on all up. Then we'd put them in a trough about, 16 feet long, a foot high and a foot wide, with running water in it. And he gave me this job. He said, "Son, we got this job for you. Now all these white eggs, you'll have to suck out." So he gave me a long tube and says, "Here, use this." And I'd suck them out. Sometimes I'd get into my mouth, but most of the time I'd spit them out before they got there. He says, "Because if one of those eggs turns rotten, it'll spoil the rest of the fish or make them so they won't hatch." I can remember when those little fish started to hatch, and I'd stand and watch them, and oh, brother, did they move.
What a great job for a young boy. You've explained about harvesting the eggs, but what did you feed them? How did that work?
We just go down to the butcher shop and get a liver, a big beef liver for 25 cents. We'd grind it up, and we'd have to make that just like milk for those fish to drink. That's how they eat, was drinking it. So when they got about a half inch long, we put them over into another pond, a little larger. And when they got into that, then we ground it a little coarser so that they could eat it. And you should see them. 4,000 or 5,000 fish jump at that liver when you throw it in. When they got about 3-4 inches long, we put them into the a larger pond, and then we grind the liver coarser in how they would eat. But he used to sell those for around 1/2 pound, and it'd be 5-6 months they'd be up to 1/2 pound. But we fed awful good and had a good water system, so they was taken care of good. But one day he come to me and he said, I was about 6 then, I guess. He says, "Son, we're going to have a party tonight. We've got to catch a couple of bucketfuls of fish." So I went down with him, and he used to have a pipe we could just open up, and the fish would go out, and then we'd catch them in this sack he had there, and take them out and take what we wanted and throw the rest back. And I remember how we cleaned fish, man. I thought we'd never get done with those fish. But he sure used to raise some nice ones.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us, Grandpa. Tell us some more about your dad and the work you did with him.
I remember he used to have quite an apple orchard. And he used to take these apples up to Huntsville and sell them. And I used to go with him. I remember we used to put straw on the bottom of the sleigh and put the apples, bushels of apples in so they wouldn't freeze them, then cover them with a canvas, then put straw on top of them, an old quilt, whatever we had. And we'd take off for Huntsville. We got up there one day and sold all the apples and went down to this man's place called Gents Winter and stayed there all night. And Dad and them used to play cards quite a bit, so they sit up till about 11 o'clock playing cards, and I just kind of doze and wake up and doze. Dad went out to see how the horses was, and when he came back, why, he says to Gents Winter, he says, "Have you got a lantern?" Gents Winter says, "What do you want a lantern for?" And he says, "There's a baby down by the river. It's crying and needs some help." And Gents Winter says, "You come back," and he says, "Come in the house," he says. "You don't need to land her. That's a panther," he says. "You go down there, he'll pounce on you." So the next morning, I went out with Dad to feed the horses, and sure enough, he'd been all around the horses looking things over to see what was there, but he hadn't bothered anything. And they said he didn't bother much around there unless it was a real young calf or a sheep, then he might bother. But they kept on, and they'd keep him away from time to time.
Wow, what a great story. Thank you for sharing that. Now, in your earlier years as a young boy, your parents moved to Alamo, Idaho. Can you tell us what you remember about moving there?
I remember when my dad and Uncle Floyd went to Idaho to take up a homestead. And they took his little black mare that he used to drive and Floyd's sorrel mare. They hitched him onto a buckboard and took off. They had gone for about a week, 10 days. When they come back, Dad says, "We're going to move to Idaho." And I remember he had to sell his place, and he had about 10 acres up by the mountain, dry land, and he sold that. He traded it to Roni Skeens for $1,000 and an old 1907 Model Ford with a rumble seat on the back. And I remember we rode around town a few times with that, and then we started out. And we got as far as Snowville with it, and then there was no way of getting gas. Nobody had gas out that way. And so then we had to pull it. And it got so we'd take the lead team off and pull him for about 3 miles, and then I'd ride the horses back. And I was only 8 years old then, too, and I'd ride the horses back and hitch onto the wagon, and the four horses would pull it. And then Joe Hansen was helping us move out there, and he'd hand me the line and say, "Here, son, drive the four horses." And boy, did I think I was somebody driving them four horses. But we was 15 days moving out, and it rained nearly every day on us. At night, we'd put up a big tent, clear it off and put up a big tent, and we'd stay in there. And then we had a white top pulling behind the hay rack full of furniture and stuff. And we'd load all our tent and equipment and stuff there, and then we'd get the grandmother and Roy and Lena would ride in the white top, and Mother and Mabel, my sister, baby then, and Dad would ride in the Ford, and I'd pull them up away and then come back.
Sounds like a huge undertaking to move back then. What were the traveling conditions like?
When we got outside of Snowville, there was no roads. It was all washed out, and we had to make new roads clear across that flat. It took us better than 3 days to go from Snowville to Alamo, and that's only about 55 miles.
My goodness, that makes me grateful for modern transportation. Where did you live when you arrived?
When we got there, we moved into an old log house. We stayed there about a week, I guess. That was in September. And then that fall, he went down to the river and bought this old home or old place down there. It was 40 acres. Then mother took up a 40-acre desert act, and grandmother took 160. That gave us 240 acres there. And dad just relinquished his homestead rights and forgot about them. And so he couldn't take up land anymore, so that's the way we've done it from then on.
Tell our listeners what it was like to live out on the homestead in Alamo, Idaho during that time period. You must have had some crazy adventures. What do you remember about them?
I can remember some of the days there when we lived down on that old ranch. The next spring, my dad bought me a .22 rifle, single shot, and I was pretty good at it. I could shoot rabbits and stuff. And I was out raking hay one day, and about 15 great big old sage hens flew in and lit right close to me. And it was about two blocks away from the house, and I run all the way to the house and got this .22 and all the way back. And when I got there, I was out of wind. So I just laid the gun across the wheel and shot one's head and got him right in the head. And I just throwed the gun, run, grabbed him, and dad and mother was over. He was cutting hay, and she'd taken him out some coffee and cake and stuff. And I run over just as fast as I could with this big sage hen, and it was a big one, rooster. And I said, "Dad, I got a wild turkey." "No," he said, "that's just a sage hen, son." I remember mother took that home, cleaned it, put it in salt water, and the next day she roasted it for dinner.
Oh, wow. You must have been really proud of yourself. You ate it, right?
Oh, that was pure good. That's the best thing I ever tasted. And I want to tell you right now that when we lived out there in the summertime, we had plenty of sage hens. That's about all we lived on, was sage hens and trout. Of course, Dad used to kill about two, three pigs in the spring, and mother would smoke them, so we'd have ham and bake them during the summer, too. But then when the thrashers and them came, why, she had some tame chickens that she used to kill, and we used to have a lamb or two we'd kill for them. And we didn't dare to kill the chickens then, the wild chickens.
Thanks, Grandpa, for sharing that. Now, there was times where you had to go to school, right? You had an education. Tell me what it was like to be educated in the early 1900s in Alamo, Idaho.
We used to go to school at Alamo, and it was 3.5 miles, and we'd drive that in a little horse and buggy. I'll tell you, it used to get cold sometimes. Mother used to have those big rocks, and she'd put them in the oven at night, and they'd get warm, they'd stay, and then the next morning she'd make a fire early, and they'd stay warm till we got up there. We used to have a horse we drove, and every once in a while, coming home, that horse had a colt, and she just didn't want to go, and she'd back us off in the ditch and everything else. But we managed anyway as kids, the four of us, and went to school.
Wow, very different than the way education and travel to education happens today. Now, living out there in that time period, you probably came across Native Americans frequently. Tell me about that.
The Indians used to come out there a lot and get pine nuts, and they used to come through right past, that was the main road right past our house. So they'd go by there, and this one time the Indians came, and Dad and Mother had gone up to Alamo, and we was all alone there. So he come to the door and knocked, and I went to the door, and "What do you want?" He said, "I want some hay." He couldn't talk too plain, but I could understand him. So I went down, and he and the squaw was used to pack the hay out, see. So she laid the rope down, and I throwed out. Finally she said, "Nap." And Dad used to charge him 2 bits when he'd do that for him. And he'd give her all she could drag out for 2 bits, and she'd take quite a load. But this old buck, he wouldn't do nothing. So he went on, and so I let him have the hay. And so he says, "How much?" And I said, "You can have it." I remember Lena and Roy and Tilly standing up in the window looking out, scared to death, afraid the Indians was going to get me. But I had the pitchfork in hand, so I wasn't too scared of them. Well, I'll get a little fun out of it anyway.
You sound like a very brave young man who's up for adventure and very responsible. Now, you still had connections in Ogden. How often did you go down and visit?
My dad and mother used to take turns coming to Ogden. Dad had come down in the spring, and dad and grandmother would come down in the spring, and mother and I would come down in the fall and get this fruit and take it back. This one time I remember, we was coming home, we had an awful load of fruit on, and the wheels was getting loose on the buggy, and so I don't know where I found them, but I had some sacks someplace, and I'd lay these sacks over the wheel and pour water on them at night, And I'd even get up in the night and pour water on them and soak the hubs. And Dad, when he got home, Dad says, "So wonder this wagon, this buggy didn't break down with you, the load you've got in it." And Mother says, "Well, Ernie soaked them every night." He said, "That kid's pretty smart at that, isn't he?" So, you see, I wasn't so dumb after all.
I don't think you were dumb at all. I don't think your parents thought you were dumb either. In fact, I think that they thought you were quite responsible. Tell me about your mother living on the homestead as a woman. How did she do that?
I want to tell you that mother of mine was a real worker. Her and grandmother used to milk 15 cows, and Dad would give them the money from the cream that they'd separate, and that was their money. And they'd have that to buy a few little trinkets with and try to keep the house with best they could. And she used to work real hard. She'd go out in the field until I was old enough to throw bundles on the wagon. She'd throw them to me and I'd stack them. When I got about 11 and a half, well, then I started throwing bundles and she'd stack them. And I remember we used to haul hay. We'd haul about 35 loads a day when we had the whole crew there. And I used to drive the teams in and out and tromp hay and stuff. And one day a fellow that was running the Jackson Fork had one of his cows bloated and he had to go home and take care of it. So I pulled in and I said, "Shall I unload this one?" Dad said, "You can't unload." And I said, "Yes, I can." And he said, "Well, try it out." So leaning back the horse up for me, and I hooked her in, and boy, I done just wonderful. And from then on, Dad says, "You'll have to run the derrick from now on, because that's your job." So I did. And we used to haul our hay, and two crops is all we got. They was good ones, and we'd have a lot of hay. So we carried on with our grain the same way. We put our grain up with the Jackson Fork, and we had big stacks. And I remember when those thrashers used to come in there and stay for a week, 10 days, the thrashers, and they had horses. I can see them old tumbling rods going now, and they have to stand and feed the thrasher by hand, and it'd take four or five guys on this stack. Sometimes it'd take 2 days to thrash a stack. We'd have them so big, barley. And they had this old straw carrier, no blower, and I'd stand in front of that and throw that away. Nobody else would do it. And they'd keep bragging me up, and the more they'd brag me up, the faster I'd work. So when we did get a straw carrier, or a blower came in there, I grabbed it. I said, "Nobody gets this. I took care of the straw before, and I'm going to take care of it now." And I just blow that straw all over. Man, did I have fun doing that. And the guy says that come along with the thrasher and it was supposed to do it, they put him down on the measuring grain and helped him sack it up. So I had the good job after all out of it.
Sounds like you got along with your mom pretty well, too. What kind of adventures did you have with her?
My mother used to like this watercress, and we'd go up to the Reed Springs and get this watercress, take it home, put it in the tub, and she'd have watercress for 2-3 days that way. And I was just putting one boot on to go out in there, and it was kind of miry there, water was running about, 5-6 inches deep right there, but of course it was deeper in other places. And it was in the spring of the year when the water reached the Snake River, and the big fish had come up there, and she see this big fish coming down. I'd say an inch and a half of it was sticking out of the water as it came. It was about 4 inches or wide, or a little better maybe, a big long thing. He says, "Oh my Lord, look at that big fish," and throw the pitchfork, short-handled pitchfork, and it went right through its gills and stuck it into the bank. Man, I never stopped for nothing. I just run right out through that mud and stuff and lost the other boot, grabbed that big fish, and it weighed about 6 pounds, I imagine. It was a good size one. And boy, was she ever thrilled about that.
Wow.
So we went home and told Dad, and he says, "You two have a lot of experience, don't you?" And I said, "We sure do."
Oh, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. Do you have any more great experiences from living on the homestead?
Another time, I wanted to build a little chicken coop for my bandies, and Mother would go with me up into the hills, and we'd cut logs, and I'd bring it home, and I built me the nicest little log chicken coop you ever seen. My dad said, "Someday you're going to be a builder and you can build your own house." That's what it turned out to do. 2 or 3 houses were built.
Oh, I love that. What great parents. Very supportive in your growth. That's really neat. Thank you so much for sharing those qualities of your parents. Now, I recently learned that it was while you were in Alamo that your music education started to take shape. and it was due to the fact that your parents were so encouraging. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Alamo had a brass band. They took up a collection and bought all these instruments, and they gave my dad a E-flat alto, and he wouldn't let anybody touch that, no way under the sun. So one day, when he came to Utah, him and grandmother, mother let me play it, and I got that thing, and I learned all the bugle calls on it. I had a friend who used to be a bugler in the Army, and an old man, and he taught me all the bugle calls. So when Dad came home, he came home one day earlier, and we figured, and I was sitting in there just blowing. I'd practiced 2-3 hours a day, and I was in there just a blowing them bugle calls, and in the door he come, "Who's blowing that horn?" When he see it was me, he says, "Son, we'll get you a trumpet tomorrow."
I love it.
So there's an old fellow up there in the City of Rocks, had a little sharp trumpet about, oh, that thing didn't seem like it was more than 8-9 inches long. The name of it was Peppers. And we had a big boar pig there that he wanted to buy, so Dad just loaded that in the back end of the wagon we had there and took it up to him, trading for that cornet. And so then I started playing in the band, and I go up there, you know, this old band man would take us in and show us a few, and he says, "If you want to come a little earlier," he says, "I'll help you and learn some of these tunes and help you to read music." And I picked it up awful quick. It was easy for me to learn it, and after I'd hear the tunes 4 or 5 times, I could play them anyway without the music. But I still had to have the music there in case sometimes I just couldn't think where it's coming. I'd have to look at it. And they wanted me to play second cornet, and I said, "No, I won't do that," because I said, "I've furnished my own instrument. I want to play lead."
That's pretty confident.
So I said, "All right." And within, they had 3 lead players then. Within 3 weeks, all 3 lead players had moved out, and they just had me to play lead. And the old band instructor, he'd play once in a while with me and help me out. Boy, I could blow that thing as loud as a firecracker, and I sure could hold up for a long while on it, too. And they had me playing lead in the band for a long, long while. Then Dad says, "Why don't we start an orchestra?" And he started my sister on the violin with Al Stout. He was only 9 years old. And it wasn't too long till we had a little orchestra going, and we'd play for the dances around there. Then he came down to Ogden. I remember coming down with him. We bought a piano and took it back. And this girl that moved up on the hill just above us there could play the piano. So she practically moved in with us. And every night for an hour and a half, we'd sit and practice. And we'd learn all these tunes so they could dance to them. And like the two-step and waltz and three. Then when this "You Wore a Tulip" and some of them tunes come in, why, we learned them. And then they started to ragging to them. And the bishop, he wasn't going to let them rag, so he'd push them off, wouldn't let them rag. And everybody started to ragging. So finally he got so bad he couldn't hold them off, and he started doing it himself. And he said, "Well, that isn't a bad dance after all."
Can you tell us exactly what ragging is? What does it mean?
But it was just like a foxtrot. But they called it the rag then, and there was some new dance that just came out.
Interesting. Tell me a little bit more about your family band and some of the venues that you played at.
Whenever we'd have a celebration, why, they'd have about 4 or 5 towns would all come to Alamo, and we'd go to them for 4 or 5 days. They'd all have a dance, and we had to play for their dances at night. And we got $2 apiece for playing for 3 hours.
You probably felt like you were loaded.
When we go to these celebrations, why, Dad would give me 10 cents, and he says, "That's all I can afford. You'll have to earn your money running for races."
Sounds like a smart dad. He must know what his son's capable of, huh?
My sister and I used to practice. We had a place there. We cleaned off and swept off some ice and kept it, and we'd run practice on that for months ahead. And so when they'd start the racing, why, her and I both had run all the way from our age up to 5, 6 years older than us and win them all. I'd come out of there with maybe $1.50, $2. And I'd have all kinds of money then to spend, but up till they had that other, all I'd have was maybe a ice cream cone or a bar of candy or something. But after that, racing, then we had plenty of money to spend. And then at night, we'd go to dance. And we used to give our money to our mother so she could buy our clothes and keep us in shoes and stuff.
So at a young age, you were earning your own money from clothing, from running races. That is very admirable.
And by the way, I never did have a pair of button socks until I moved down here. My grandmother used to knit them all out of wool. And she used to go and along the fences and gather the wool that the sheep, when they went through it, tear it off on the fence. And I've helped her gather this wool too. And when we find the dead sheep, well, we'd go pull the wool and she'd take it down, wash it and cart it and spin it. She had a spinning wheel and make, then she'd darn our socks or knit socks for us and gloves too. And that's the way we had our, kept our feet warm.
It seems like everybody who lived back then was a jack of all trades. Well, Grandpa, we appreciate you sharing your youthful stories with us and growing up in Alamo, Idaho, and what it was like to grow up on that ranch out there. We hope our listeners, members of your posterity, have enjoyed it as well. And we invite you to listen to the upcoming podcasts of Ernie in his teenage years. Thank you for joining us, Grandpa, on the Family Story Podcast. Thank you for joining us today on the Family Story Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Family Story Podcast is a production of Harmony Audio Recordings. This podcast is strictly prohibited for use without permission. For more information about Family Story Podcast or to create your own Family Story Podcast, contact us at familystorypodcast.com. We hope you join us again soon and encourage you to go create a family memory today.